Hi, I'm Becky Sims, and welcome to Behind the Future, the podcast from Aspiration Digital. We're here to unlock digital careers, one conversation at a time. On each episode, I'll be joined by a student co-host. We'll be interviewing amazing people from across the industry to learn about how they got started in their career and what it is that they do. Let's dive in to find out the secrets to their success. Well, that was fun chatting with Dan, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was, yeah.
What was most impactful from what he was sharing with us?
Well, I think he kind of opened a new door for me in terms of knowledge of product design. Like, I now understand the importance of a product and that every little bit of a product is important as to why a customer would buy it. And also just in general, Dan himself, like the fact that he took a big step from management to design. Yeah, that was really inspiring. Yeah.
Well, it just shows you don't have to know what you need, what you want to do. And if you take one route, you can lead into another. So I guess on that note, let's dive into Dan's story.
I'm Dan, and I'm taking you behind the future.
Welcome to another episode of Behind the Future. And I am joined by the fantastic Ruhan. Ruhan, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Ruhan, and I'm a year 12 student currently studying sociology, media and politics.
Amazing. Fantastic. And we have a wonderful guest with us today. We have Dan. Dan, tell us a bit about yourself.
Thanks, Becky. Yeah, I'm Dan. So I'm a product designer at Lab. I'm obviously Irish. My background when I studied was kind of undergrad in engineering, mechanical engineering. And as a graduate, I came out, went into management consultancy at Accenture. And after a few years of that, I went back and did a master's in design innovation, which eventually led to me transitioning into design. And I've been at Lab for about 2.5 years now. Loving it, loving design, loving the career. So yeah.
Wow, there is a lot to pick into there, isn't there? So Ruhan, over to you for the first question.
So how did your time at Accenture influence your transition into product design?
Yeah, I think it's funny because I kind of accidentally fell into a lot of the careers that I've had, the jobs that I've had, the careers still ongoing. But when I was in secondary school, I was quite into, like, I loved maths and physics. I was really good at those subjects. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. So my mother convinced me to do engineering because it was quite a general degree. Just didn't really know what to do. So when I was doing the degree, the company actually came into the college, probably something like what you would do, Becky, and they were looking for interns. So in my final year, I did an internship with them, and then I went into consultancy with Accenture, got a grad program off the back of that. And it was quite a general grad program, still didn't really know what I was doing too much, and did about 4 years there. And I think over the 4 years, it was quite a massive company, like really, really big. They, like, their global footprint's about 500,000 people. And I learned a lot from a lot of people, but I think I was still wanting to, like, make things and create things. It was a lot of, like, you know, the projects you would get would be like 2 months and you go in and kind of advise on something, but you didn't really see it through. I did learn an awful lot about digital, about tech, about working in a company and in the corporate environment. But it did leave me with a little bit of, I really wanted to, like, actually kind of make things and, like, bring things from start to finish. So I think that was kind of, that's when I started. And it did introduce me to design and design thinking. But I think it did give me that first step. And then I, from there, really wanted to, just make things and design things. And it kind of set me on that path as the first step, I guess.
Amazing. Yeah. You mentioned design thinking. What's design thinking?
Yeah, so it's kind of a methodology that you would use to create you use it in a lot of different fields, but it kind of is all about putting, like, people at the heart of what you're doing. It's kind of really been curious. So it's a methodology that you kind of go from, defining what the problem is, like understanding and then unpicking that problem, and then starting to, like, co-create and solution what the solution itself could be. When I was in Accenture, I didn't really know what it was before, but I kind of learned the framework and, like, the different steps that you would go through. I really liked that kind of way of problem solving and how you create things. And then that what kind of, like, yeah, got me into design from there. It's an interesting kind of, I guess, toolkit or methodology to have.
Well, it helps guide your thinking, doesn't it?
Exactly,
actually putting people at the heart. Well, that feels very relevant to what we do now, which is important.
Yeah.
From an Accenture point of view, when you were working there, what kind of consultancy, like what did a project look like? What type of things were you doing?
Yeah, it was very varied, which was really good when I started my career. Like I worked as like a reporting specialist at one point for like in Facebook in Dublin. We had like a very large like operation footprint. So we would go in and there'd be like 1,000 like people contracted in from Accenture. And I would be looking at reports for some of the sales teams or that kind of thing. And then you would do like some research projects as well. So you might get a call up to be like, next week we're looking at the payments in Latin America, and you'd be like, okay, we're gonna do a research project on that. So it was quite a lot of different roles and responsibilities. You kind of get a good feel for different aspects of consultancy. So it was good. It was a good way to figure out what you wanted, because I think there's so much uncertainty when you're starting off for many years to like, what the hell am I going to do, or what do I like or want to do? So I think some of those programs that give you kind of a taster for different things is really, really good to just to learn that really. Yeah. And I spent a good few of my years in my 20s trying to figure out what I really wanted to do. I think I've got there. Yeah, so.
Well, it's hard to know until you do it, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. It's, yeah.
And I guess that exposure piece and learning those business skills, because I'm like in consulting, that's the core of it, is a lot of business skills, isn't it? How to handle relationships, how to build relationships. Sure. And
yeah, I think a big one is like working with clients and how you conduct yourself, and a lot of soft skills as well. It's presenting and just meetings and a lot of things, like, and the quality of your work as well, which I think there's a certain, if you're doing a presentation deck on a research paper, there's a standard that gets set by the people and the team around you, and then you kind of understand, okay, that's what I have to do to make sure that this is to the right level. So there's a lot of, I guess, intangibles almost, and it's just you kind of build up those as well as kind of figuring out what you want to like specialize or what route your career you want to go down in as well. So
yeah,
that's what, there was a lot of those kind of elements to it as well.
Yeah, so you spoke about being in your 20s and like not knowing what to do. So would you say there were like any challenges from shifting to design, or
there was a good few. I think because I hadn't done like a graphic design background, I was very like, yeah, engineering, problem solving, logical kind of thinking, analytical. Matt, who I work with, would probably say our brains are quite different, and he's a very like chaotic creative brain, and I'm a little bit more spreadsheets and like that. So when I started working with Lab, I hadn't spent like hours looking at like a poster for something and like really moving imagery and visuals and text around the page, trying to like get it into the right perfect place. So I remember there was times when we had projects with clients and I would be doing up like a website page or something, and I would do like maybe one or two, and I would just kind of try and get things into the right place, and then I wasn't quite getting to the right level of where I wanted the page to be. And then Matt would kind of show me his process, where he would do like 30, and he would just do like, he would do one, get it around, and then he would duplicate it, and then he would start moving things around again and like make the imagery in the background bigger, or around these corners, like make the text bigger here, push it over here. And he would just do that, and he would do it so many times, I couldn't believe how many he had done on the page for one specific thing. And at the end, he would pull out one and be like, yeah, okay, we've got to it now. And I'd be like, oh, okay, this is what we have to do. This is the number of kind of trial and error you have to go through. So some of the processes or things that you would do are a bit different in terms of that design and that almost like, yeah, graphic design or visual design element. So that took me a little bit of time to kind of get that into my bones and like take on that kind of approach, because I just hadn't come from that kind of background in terms of, you know, we would just do the slide and the slide would just be done pretty quickly then, and you would kind of move on. But with trying to get some of the like website or app designs to the right place, you really have to do a lot of variations to figure it out and get the right result really. Yeah.
And on those 30 variations, is it then on gut feel, or is it like, can you test it? What's the process there for making that decision?
I guess the point, like, so from a UX and UI, so the user experience side would be, you know, what you put on the page, like what does the user need to see in terms of the text or the imagery or the buttons? So you kind of will put that in like a black and white component for the webpage or whatever you're designing. And then from the visual design aspect, that's when you're kind of, you've got the kind of your nuts and bolts, and then you will start to move it around. And I think in terms of gut, there is an element of like you develop an eye for what looks good, but you also have to come at it from, it's kind of three angles. It's like your own taste. There's like the client's taste or like what they have in their head that they want. And then there's also the user who's actually going to be using the product. So the client has their own, like I will, they'll have their own, what they want and feel. And that might be slightly different when the business's brand guides. But then the users or like who's actually using the product might have a very different like idea of what they want to see on a website. So like yourself and you, Becky, might have very different ideas of what I want to see on like a Spotify app, how you would design it. So you're kind of juggling different people's opinions and like what they want on the page or on the screen. So you kind of have to take that into account as well as your own gut for, I guess your gut as well is like what looks good in the context of all of that as well. Yeah. And trying to get the right.
Yeah, divorce your own feeling a little bit if you're not the target market, I guess.
Yeah, which is hard to do, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose ultimately that is the most important people to be appealing to, but actually the client doesn't always get that, do they?
yeah, you definitely, I mean, a lab all the time, it's kind of, we try and put people at the heart of everything from a behavioral and from a user experience and design. It's like you are creating these digital products for people, they will be using them, so you need to think about how it's working and how it'll work best for them, not best for you or best for the client that's in the room. It's trying to get the best outcome for, yeah, the end user, really. So, people is, yeah, super important for everything we do, really.
Yeah. And I guess you've learned a lot. And I suppose your consultancy background helped with how do you manage those conversations with clients, because it's really tricky. And I've been there and seen it before when a client's like, I don't like it. And you're like, you're not the target market. And like, you need to appreciate it, but you don't need to like it. It needs to meet the brand guidelines. And is there any thoughts around that? And is that a skill set you realized was going to be important to design? Or was that kind of a, I hadn't really thought about this part.
Yeah. No, it's, I think the consultancy background definitely helped with a lot of that, because you do go into, you're presenting work to people a lot. And you really have to detach your own ego as well, because people will literally say, I don't like that, or I hate that. And they're not attacking you, but they're attacking your design a lot, maybe sometimes. but they don't, most of the time, it's not malicious. It's not like, I don't like you. You are not the work. That took a while to learn as well. You do have to kind of take that away. But I think there's a lot of storytelling around your work as well, for any job, really, for design as well. If you're going in and you're saying, I've designed this home screen for like a new variant of Spotify's homepage or whatever, you have to kind of tell the story around why you made the decisions you did. You know, I've moved the search up to the top instead of at the bottom, or I've put this button bottom right because people's thumbs can reach that point of the screen easiest place. Mm-hmm. It's better to put it down there instead of up at the top. And if you kind of explain and tell the client why you've done what you've done, it will sell it much, much easier, and they'll understand all of the small decisions that added up to this screen. So I think, being able to present to clients from the consultancy side was, that was really, really valuable going in, because that's not something that you, if you kind of do UX or UI courses online, you don't get taught that side of it so much. It's kind of like focused on, you know, moving the pixels around in Figma or whatever it might be. But it's a really important part, because unless they understand and get on board with what you've done, you just kind of, like anything, if you throw something in front of someone and say, here's what I've done, they'll be like, okay, but they can only get the context from what you see, and that story is really important to go along with it as well.
Yeah. Do you know what? We talk about storytelling so much on this podcast, because so much of business comes back to storytelling. Because at the end of the day, we're all humans buying things from each other, whether that's buying ideas or buying products, services. But there's got to be a story behind it, hasn't there?
Massively. Yeah. I think like storytelling is such a very core of what like being a person and a human is. It's like, obviously goes back since, you know, cave drawings and stuff. People put stories on walls. So everyone can kind of, everybody identifies with stories, whether it's, you know, Disney or if it's trying to tell a client or explain to a client what you've done on a call. So yeah, it's massive. It's a super underrated and really difficult skill as well to get right. It's because it sounds like it should be much easier than it is, but I think it's one of the hardest things to do really well is tell like a really brilliant story. It's quite hard. So, but yeah, it's really important.
And is it critical to all designers and creatives to be good at that? Or I guess, are there scenarios in bigger businesses where you can just do your creative and someone else goes and does that bit for you with the clients, et cetera? Because some people might be sitting here thinking, oh, I'm so creative, but the thought of that bit, I don't want to do the client bit. Does that happen? Is that...
You can do. I mean, in places like Accenture, the teams are big. You know, everyone gets a little bit more specialized. At Lab, you know, we're a smaller company. There's like two of us in the design team. So we kind of do a bit of everything all the time. So in those bigger teams, you know, there can be instances where it's segregated up a little bit more. I would expect a designer to kind of present back their work and explain it. But yeah, there definitely can be cases where, even actually with us sometimes, like someone else will kind of take the client through or I will tag someone in Figma, the tool we use to design things, and I'll just tag the client and say, here's the design. I'm always hesitant to do that because I know they won't get the storytelling side of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can sell it as well. But yeah, I think it's always better for the person who's done the work to explain and go through what they've done. I just think it makes the most sense, but it does happen for sure.
Yeah, I agree. And I suppose that's a skill that actually at school you can already be honing, like when you're doing projects, like whether they're creative projects or not, but that ability to get time to talk for you with your teacher, with the class, etc., to be able to articulate what you've done. Because as you say, yeah, just handing something to someone without the context is so hard to then get what you're hoping for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You spoke about before how people have different views on products and how they view it. So I want to talk about you. So if you were to design any digital product without constraints, what would it be?
Yeah, that's a big question. I have had an idea for, I don't know if you use Letterboxd. It's like a film review app. But me and my friends are kind of like, I'm kind of addicted to it. I love film and TV and stuff. But basically after every time I watch a film, my girlfriend kind of asks me because I can't help but take my phone out immediately and I go to review it, sort of like IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes. But I have kind of wanted to try and create a London theatre. I'm into theatre as well in London and plays. I would love to create a Letterboxd for London theatre so that people could go on and upload the different West End shows and like off West End as well. And create because Letterboxd is a great community aspect where people will review films and some of them are quite funny, and then they'll kind of like that, comment on that, creates kind of like a community feel around film. I've started to using some of the tools that we use in Lab. I've started to try and actually build it with some AI tools. So, you know, watch the space. It might come out, who knows? But I think that would be the one that I would love to try and build. It would be, I think it would be, because it kind of marries two of my loves, I guess, like theatre and design. So that would be, that would be something I'd love to do, yeah.
Oh, you heard it here first.
Yeah.
I also love that though, because actually into your personal life, creative lives on, doesn't it? Like the fact that you love theatre and film and because we're surrounded by creative, but actually you're immersing yourself in so many different types of creative. Do you think that helps fuel your creativity?
Yeah, I think so. I think you never know where inspiration or ideas can come from. It's like the storytelling aspect. There's amazing storytelling obviously in this city in London, but in film as well, and you can take so many learnings from that. I listen to a lot of screenwriting podcasts, and they'll really break down films and scenes, and there's a lot that you can take in terms of that storytelling, how you can do it. But yeah, in terms of I think it's great to go to museums and see different art, whether you like it or you don't. But it's I guess the human experience is so much more than just on a screen. And I think it's super important to get yourself into different scenarios, even different, meet different people, different perspectives, different points of view, really enrich your own creative practice. And it just makes you a more well-rounded person and practitioner. So yeah, I'd be a big advocate for Just trying to see and consume, and consume might be a little bit more of it, but like seeing art and getting that into your life, I think is really important. For all parts of your life, really.
I love that. Where do your best ideas come from? Where are you when they happen? Are you a shower guy? Is it because some people say that's when the ideas come in, when they're not even trying? And I always find that hard for a designer, because actually when you're sat at the laptop told right design and you're like, oh, I need to get away, I need the idea. But where do your best ideas come?
Walks, I think. Because I kind of work from my living room a lot, you're kind of sat in one place a lot of the time, and you're kind of in front of a screen, and it's a very static place to be a lot. And I think I think it's scientifically proven that if you get out and start walking in the fresh air and you're not listening to music or podcasts or anything, if you can try and cut that out, you just kind of, and you sit with your own kind of brain, it kind of, those connections will start to spark around everything. I think Einstein used to, I don't know if this is true now, I saw this on the internet, so, fact check it. But I think he used to go out in a boat with no motor, and he would just like float for like hours, and he would just kind of sit there with his thoughts and think, and all of that subconscious that's kind of under the surface will start to like fire off connections. And that's where he would kind of come up with E equals MC² and things. But a walk is definitely, I think, where I come up with my best stuff, and or like, just kind of letting yourself sink into a project or a problem space. I think that's where you can, for me anyway, it works quite well. So that's usually where my go-to.
I love that. And I suppose the modern way of working, I think more businesses appreciate that, don't they? Like, obviously you work as part of Human First Collective, but if I knew you were out having a walk in the middle of the day to help be creative, I wouldn't be like, why are you not at your desk working? It's like, no, go get on that walk. Come on, we want the best ideas. And I suppose trying to help people realize that you've got to do what's best for you, because a walk might not be it for someone else. That might be, I don't know, too distracting. They might want to be on the lake in the boat and not moving. Like, who knows? But it's I guess getting to know yourself and learn what helps you is really important.
Just a quick note from me. We'd love you to hit the subscribe button. This helps us more than you might realize when it comes to growing this podcast, ensuring we can bring you the best guests possible. Thank you. Back to the episode.
Yeah, would you say, so going on walks does help a lot, I would agree, but would you say that's the most exciting part of designing? The fact that you can go on a walk and these ideas will just spawn into your head?
Yeah, I think that moment of that's a great idea, or I should try that. I think that is, those are great. And I also think that's one. I think the other thing that I really like is when you kind of get into that state of flow. I think it can be hard to attain sometimes. Some people get into it a lot easier than others, but if you kind of are like doing loads and loads of versions of a poster or a website, and you're kind of in there for like 3 hours, and next time you kind of like come back to yourself and you haven't felt the time go by at all, that's really satisfying to try and get into that kind of deep focus. And I think it's less of a, because the moments of like good ideas and things are very exciting and they're very like high spike, but the flow is kind of much more a kind of a level place to be. That's really nice. So that's another one as well, I think, that I find is really satisfying to try and hit that place of our headspace, I guess.
Then like there's the like idea of being creative and like thinking of new ideas, but I think nowadays, I'm sure you're aware, like the evolution of digital tools and AI, because of these factors, what do you think the future of product design looks like now?
It's quite interesting, because the tools that are coming out are really, really like kind of mind blowing. And the things that you can do with them are really great. Like the app, the theater app that I mentioned, I would never have been able to like start making a actually developed prototype. Like I could do the screens and like it would be, you could do all the visuals and do all the UX design, but to actually be able to code and build a functional prototype, because I can't. I've done some coding in my time, but I'm not a developer by any stretch. So I think what you can do now, like the number of people that can get into it and like they can build products through like prompts, like through ChatGPT and things, or there's an amazing tool called Cursor that is just mind-blowing. Like you can just put in a prompt to be like, give me this app, and it will start to build all the back-end code and everything. So I think the future is going to be like a lot of people building a lot of very niche things, because you'll be able to create something for yourself essentially that doesn't exist. I think I saw an article from one of the editors of the New York Times, and he was just saying that it's like almost a micro building, where he was like, oh, there's nothing out here that does this really specific thing that I need in Excel. And he's like, I just wanted to build this really small website function or Chrome extension that would just do this thing for me. And now you can.
Yeah.
So it's like it's going to be a lot of people building a lot of very specific niche things that maybe they will roll it out to more people and create small business out of it. Maybe they won't. But I think it's really democratizing. It's a tricky word for me to say, but just putting a lot of power into a lot of people's hands that could never have done it before. So it's really exciting. And I like when I started using some of the tools, I was just like, oh, wow. Like you can really do what you want now. And it's great. Yeah.
How does it take away, though, do you think? Because there's been a lot of stuff in the headlines around, especially creatives, feeling like copyright's like disappearing because AI can just go create stuff and use things that already exist to create new things. And what are your thoughts on that? Is that something you're worried about being in the creative space?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's like an exciting place, but it's a scary place as well. And I think there's not really enough legislation that has caught up to, and it takes so long to like figure out what the best thing to do is around legislating things. But I know that there's a lot of fear, particularly from in artists and about copyright specifically. And I think people need to be very ethically aware and like responsible when they're using AI, because I've seen a lot of instances where that doesn't happen, but I think everyone has a responsibility to in every aspect of life to use tools responsibly. And if you don't really use your own critical thought and just kind of plow ahead with something and not take into consideration what harm it could cause or what might go like wrong with it, then I think you're moving too fast in terms of using it without taking a pause to, I think it's happening so much now because the number of apps that are going to be launched in the App Store very quickly, and there's going to be a lot of people trying to take advantage of others or using generative AI to, you know, misrepresent themselves in the marketing side. I think it's, and that's always going to be the case. People will exploit things. That's kind of comes with the territory, but I think it's quite a scary position, especially like I have friends who are writers or artists, and even especially with digital art, you know, before you would have to pay someone their living to like create something digitally, and now an AI can do it in a second, and it's kind of flipped a whole industry on its head in some standpoints, and it's a very like your footing of where you stood in your life and your practice and who you are is kind of like flipped. And I think that, that brings just a lot of fear and uncertainty around what will happen. It's kind of, a bit of a tipping point.
It's so hard to know what's going to happen with it. Because also as humans, we've got a big part to play in it. We may choose that we still value art that's created by a person more than AI. And if we know and we can differentiate, there might be more value to that. But I guess as you say, legislation's going to take a long while to catch up. Like they're trying, but also it's a funny one because I feel like some of the headlines recently, a lot of the music industry artists were upset around AI having access to hearing their songs, etc. But actually, if we want AI to be as good as we want it to be, it needs to culturally know what we know. And actually, we could all right now go and put the radio on and listen to music, and that could help influence our creativity. So in some ways, we do want AI to have that. And like, we didn't have to pay the radio for that. Like if we're listening to commercial radio, that's been paid for by the advertisers, etc. We've got that knowledge. So it's a funny place. Like I feel like I'm so obviously for the creative industries and want to fight for our rights, but it's also that fine line, because if we want AI to help us as best it can, we want it to have as much human experience as it can and know the world we live in, the culture we live in. So yeah, it's I'm glad I'm not one of the legislators trying to decide what to do. And I guess we just have to embrace it, don't we? And use it. And you're doing a lot with AI, aren't you, at the moment? I mean, that would be interesting to know a bit more about.
So Matt that I work with, we've started to use Cursor, one of those the tools I mentioned previously, because now we're really able to prototype like concepts and ideas in like a week compared to maybe 6 weeks that it would take before. So when if we have a pitch that comes in for some work, we can really just like start to come up with ideas really quickly. And then to prompt engineering with these tools, you can make the prototypes, you can make like infinite walls of screens or product screens, and you can make all sorts of apps just in days, like in hours really, because it's just so quick. And once you can do that, and it might not be perfect, but you can get it into a user's hands or the client's hands, and like they say, like a prototype is worth 1,000 words, because if you can get like a working app into someone's hands and they can start to click and move around the screens, they can just get it instantly, and then they can critique that. They can say, actually, this idea is not something that we want to pursue, or it's like, okay, if we change this and this around and we refine it, then we can bring that, and then we can actually take that sort of minimal viable product into like a proper project and proper product. But I think you just learn so much faster, because it would take so much time and money that people probably would never even try, because it's like, okay, it's going to cost me 50 grand to even see if this idea works or not. Whereas if you can do that for like a fraction of the cost, for like a few grand, then you can test so many more ideas. You can learn so much more about what your user wants, what people want. And then you can either bring them into like an actual product, or you can leave it on the chopping room floor. But it just, it's really been really interesting and quite a game changer for us, to like the things that we've been able to get out in days, when, especially when you're a small team, time is money. So it's been really, really amazing to see what we're able to do so quickly.
I wonder if we'll see less failed products because people are testing things more, or whether you probably still have people that just go gung-ho and go and make it and haven't gone through the steps. But I suppose a lot of your thinking, and I imagine this was definitely helped by your consultancy background, is around research, isn't it? I've never seen you start a project without needing to do the research first and understand who the people are. Whereas you might have other people that just dive in head first. I know what I need to do. But yeah, is that grounds in everything you do, is research first?
Yeah, definitely. I think we always try and initially do secondary research, like see what's been done in the space, if it's like in the property industry, you know, we want to speak to people who've bought a house. We want to see what their experience was like using the client's website, or on Rightmove using the app. You want to, because I think it helps you so much as well if you're in an industry or space that you're not super familiar with yourself, if you can get chatting to people and understand their perspective and watch them use a tool, then you can kind of get really familiar with it really quickly. We always try and like interview people, chat to them about like their life experiences, what their kind of headspace is like going into using an app like Rightmove, saying how, like watching them go through every screen, from like what the search parameters are, like why do they pick this price band over this price band, and like what are they looking for and how are they using it? Because invariably you get very surprising things that people do. People will surprise you pretty much all the time. They'll do things you don't expect. They'll figure out ways to break things, not their own fault, but it's the way humans are. They'll just like figure out different avenues and use things in different ways, and that's great. It really opens your eyes to how the experience is working and how people are using it, and you can make it better, you can improve it from there. So I think doing the actual interviews with people and watching them use it is really interesting. I think it's a really enjoyable part as well, because it's a lot of fun to see someone going through an experience and getting frustrated with it in some places, and then you can like make notes and be like, okay, we really need to improve the search here because it's just not working at all. But it gives you a lot of you just get a big long list of things that you need to work on and improve. But it's just, it's because it's also, it's, if you're designing for days on end, it's kind of sometimes it, you can lose sight that, you know, there's people that are actually going to be using it, and to actually put the thing that you've made in someone's hands and watch them use it is quite fulfilling as well and rewarding. But yeah, it's all about just learning what works and what doesn't, and trying to fix things for people.
And I guess that's harder as well if you've got a product that needs to be, so I don't know, let's take Rightmove for example. You've got first-time buyers using Rightmove that are definitely potentially in Gen Z type of age bracket, through to my parents and your parents that are in that older age group. So actually how a Gen Z person uses an app and uses a website is very different, because it's completely native to them. They've never known a world where we haven't had it, through to our parents and parents' parents, who it's something they've had to learn, and maybe they don't use it as natively. Is that, how do you combat that with creative and UX?
Yeah, it's difficult, because yeah, you're so right. People will use things. I know, like I'm looking for to buy a flat at the minute, and I will, when I favorite something on the Rightmove app, I'll ring the estate agent straight away just to get in touch with them. Then other people that I've chatted to will just click email. They'll send it to your email, and then the estate agent will ring them the next day. My mom sometimes will try and send me things from Rightmove, and she doesn't really know how to share the link and stuff. So people use things in all sorts of different ways. I think it is giving options. I think the more options you can give people, because you're never, if you design something, you want to design something specifically for an audience group of people. When you have something like Rightmove, which is so prevalent through so many different brackets and audience types, giving different options to do different things and trying to make things really accessible. So it's like giving, you know, the option to email like the estate agents, or phone them up. It's forms that you can include that are really prevalent. It's really just about giving as many avenues to people as possible, and just making it really, really clear, really obvious. I think using like well-known patterns for design and those kind of apps is really useful, because if someone is switching between apps and they can recognize typical patterns that they see, it makes it easier for them. They'll be able to understand, okay, I know this, I've seen this, this is what this is. So I think, it's, and accessibility, you know, giving people the ability to go through a website without needing to use a keyboard, through voice, or if it is just without a mouse, different things like that as well. It's all about, you know, the variety in delivering the information. So I think, that would be, that would be the main thing, I think.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I remember when mobile apps started to become a big thing, and we had the hamburger menu first come in.
Yeah.
But anyone that wasn't used to it, and they were only used to desktop, they wouldn't know what you mean. But the little button with the little lines on it that looks like a hamburger, we all now know, oh, I go and click on that and I'm going to get the full menu and I know where to go. But it's just this journey you go on, and this evolution. And sometimes change has to happen, and you have to wait for people to catch up to know the technology, which feels mad that I could even call that technology now. It's just so built into us. But there was a point where people didn't know that what that was, and didn't know how to navigate with their fingers on their phone like we do today. It's interesting.
I think products need to be made for them to be easy to use, and like having a lot of options as well, like you said. And I've heard that you said that a senior designer also taught you a lot about design. So what would you say, having said about products being easy to use and things like that, what's the like key lesson would you say he taught you about design?
Yeah, I've probably kind of mentioned one of them anyway, with kind of just the amount of variations that you need to go through. That was a big learning for me in terms of the visual design. And I think it sounds very simple as well, but keeping the question of like, what am I trying to achieve here with this? Either if it's a page, or if it's the top section of a website, sometimes it can be, you can kind of be going through your design process, and it happens, you kind of almost forget what the outcome that you're trying to achieve, or like, what are you trying to do? Because every screen has a purpose, and every page has a purpose. You're trying to do something, whether it's like trying to get people to contact me, or I'm trying to get them to donate to a charity on my website. So I need like a button that says donate so that I can get them through. But everything is there for a purpose, and well, should be. Sometimes I think people forget that you need to be intentional about what you're doing on a website. People just kind of want to fill up content sometimes without having that intention. And I guess, like, to go back from an SEO perspective, that's all about intention as well. With, you're trying to get keywords in there, you're trying to increase your search position. But yeah, from a design standpoint and from what you're trying to do with the user, like what journey you're trying to bring them on, having that kind of like, just that question of, what am I trying to do? What am I trying to achieve? How can I help the person do what they're trying to achieve as easily as possible, really? So yeah, I think that was another one, keeping that kind of top of mind all the time, was, or writing it on a post-it on my computer so I kind of frame it, was a really big one as well.
It's a good idea, isn't it? One of my favorite versions of that, and I can't remember who came up with this model, but is the think, feel, do. And you can use it in so many ways. You can use it if you're designing. I use it when I'm writing a presentation. It's like, what do I want the person to think? How do I want them to feel? And what do I want them to do? And actually having that on a post-it in front of you, or like if I'm doing a deck, I'll put it at the first slide of the deck and I keep coming back to it. And it's that intentional moment, isn't it? Because if you forget that, and it's so easy to, you just doing your thing and you've kind of just got into it and you're just going on that flow. But if you've forgotten what the point was, you often then won't achieve what you were trying to achieve. So being really intentional, I feel like we talk about that a lot. Like, I think being intentional about what we're doing is always important, and we sometimes forget that. We just kind of go in with the flow. Aspiration Digital is the one-day careers conference to help young people get started in the digital industry. We are just planning our next events, and we are planning to move around the UK. So this is your opportunity. If you follow the link in the show notes, you can suggest that we come to your local area and get your school listed on the waitlist. Follow the link now and pop your details in. We hope to see you at a future event. What other questions did you have for Dan? Any others?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that you like design and products, but overall, what would you say is the most unexpected lesson you've learned about product design?
Unexpected lesson of product design. Ooh, that is a good question. Let me have a think about that one. I think one of the big things in product design, because it, you know, there's a lot of different roles like UX or UI and a lot of things broken down, but from a product design standpoint, that strategic element, like bringing in the business strategy, I think when I started off, I was really focused on like the user, and then when, as I got more skilled, that was into the visual design. But when you become like a sort of digital product designer, bringing, you know, that business side to it as well, so kind of marrying almost the consultancy with the design, to, because like businesses come to us for products, but they have a strategy, they want to make money and they want things to happen on the page, whether they get people to sign up to their newsletter, or they want people to buy their product on an e-commerce site. And I think what I've tried to do recently, like over the last few months especially, is really bring that strategic element into it. So I think learning that and marrying kind of those business skills with the design skills, that is a lesson that I've kind of really intentionally been trying to take into it as well. So that has been a big one. I think I kind of mentioned it as well, but product design, it's like, it never ceases to amaze me how people will just unexpectedly do what you don't think they will. Like, they will just, you'll see someone using what you've made, and they'll just be doing something completely random that you're like, how have you even come to that way of doing it? That will always kind of never shock me. It is just so interesting to see people using something and doing something mad that you just, you'd never would have thought that that's what they would do. Or even like we did a site for a property company, and we put like made the login option really readily available to them, and then people use it in a way that you didn't expect, and that causes an issue with the journey that you wanted people to go down. Then they'd see this other button that they're like, okay, I'll just click this, because they will just invariably click the first thing that they see on the screen almost that seems like it's right for them, and then you're like, oh okay, didn't think that they would do that. So then you have to like change things around again. So yeah, that, I think that's always a big one, is that always kind of surprises me how people use things that you make.
Do you know, there's a famous story that that reminded me of. And this was, I don't know when this was, but it was Heinz with ketchup. So they had been making ketchup for a while. It was always traditionally came in your glass bottles. And they did some research where they got families to come in and they let them have dinner at a table. And the researchers would watch what was happening. And what they noticed was the kid would want the ketchup on their plate. So the parent would get the glass bottle, or the kid would go to grab it and the parent would go, oh, no, I'll do it because it's glass. And they'd tap the top of it and they'd ration out the ketchup. But they were really careful with it because they didn't want the kid to drop the glass, etc. And it was just this eureka moment of, we need to work out how to get that bottle in the kid's hands because the kid will put a lot more ketchup on the plate than the adults putting on the plate. And there was born the plastic bottle and the squeezy bottle because they realized it was a barrier to more consumption of their product because the parent was rationing it. And it's one of those things that you just would not have known until you saw it happening in the moment. And I think, yeah, we don't always realize what's possible from or what we're missing by not seeing people using our products.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's so, like, I think physical products that people use are so interesting because I was at a research conference where this company, they do a lot of research into with people with disabilities and illnesses, and they were doing a study on how they opened like tablets, and they had a lot of video snippets of they did like a video study. They would send a pack out to people and then they would record them and like show them how they were trying to open these different tablet packets, and there were certain ones that they would really struggle with because it was like quite a big packet and maybe they had some issues with their hands and they were really struggling. They would even use like rubber bands around the lids to get more purchase on the lids and stuff. So I think if it's, you know, physical products or digital ones, watching people use things is just, you'll be like oh wow, okay, immediately I get it, because you'll never be able to put yourself in someone's shoes as well as just watching them actually do it. It's a really, I think those kind of contextual kind of inquiries or ethnographical studies are just so interesting, just to see, like, watch people in the wild kind of using a Heinz bottle or like a medicine bottle. You just learn so much so quickly. That's really interesting. Yeah,
definitely. We're in a fast-paced world at the moment. Change seems to be happening regularly. For listeners out there, how do you stay on top of what's going on? Have you got any favorite places that you go to for inspiration or to know what people are doing in the industry that might help others learn more about what's happening?
Yeah, I follow a lot of people on LinkedIn. So my LinkedIn feed has actually become quite a good, I will see like a lot of designers, and I think it's a great way to get the content that you really only want. Over the years, I've just started to follow people that I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then they'll recommend someone else to follow in product design or UX, UI design. And it starts to just fill up my feed then if I go on it daily. And I would never really have browsed LinkedIn a few years ago, but now I will actually go to LinkedIn, have a browse, and you'll see so much really good content. It's over the last years, I think people have really upped their game of what they're putting out on LinkedIn. You get so many free resources, so many things that you can use. So it's great. I have a couple of newsletters that I'll kind of sign up to as well. There's one guy, like, his name's Tommy Gyoko, but he's like a designer out in California, and his newsletters are like amazing reads. Like, they're so well written. The storytelling is brilliant. It's like I sign up to more newsletters than I actually read, but that's one that is just like, if the content's really good and it's written really well, I'll just like straight away just read that one. But I think there's so many content creators. YouTube and LinkedIn are two of my go-to, especially for YouTube, for if I'm trying to like learn a new tool, or particularly for like some of the AI stuff, I'm going straight onto LinkedIn or YouTube trying to find who's making things and just watch them. And it's just, it's a really quick way to, like, I think it's in a digital world where everyone's kind of working remotely and from home and stuff, being able to see someone's screen, and it's almost like the equivalent of looking over at someone's screen in an office or something. So yeah, those are kind of the main places that I will keep up to date with what's happening. But I think, surprisingly, LinkedIn has become like a really good place for me to just kind of have a quick pulse on like what people are talking about.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. Maybe we'll get you to give us your top five and we'll put them in the show notes for people to go and have a little follow.
Yeah.
So we'll take that as an action. Any other questions, Rehan?
I think I've said everything, yeah.
Yeah, this has been so interesting, so interesting. Is there anything we've not asked you that you're like, oh, the next generation of product designers need to know this?
No, I think the AI one is a big one for product design. I never thought I'd be able to build an app and now I can. And I think people, it's just, yeah, really exciting time to start off because you can straight away just make things so quickly. And I think that its ability to create is so exciting. And I think, you know, if you have an idea, the fact that like, if you put your mind to it in a few days, you'll have something that you can show people and be proud of. And just, and I think just like doing things is a great way to find out what you like, what you want to do. You just try lots of things and it's simple, but it is true that you just need to just get stuck in. And the more things you try, the you narrow down what you want to do. So I think it's like, despite some of the scarier elements, it's like a super exciting time for just creating things in digital and what you can do is, it's kind of mind blowing. So,
and I suppose that getting on and just creating stuff helps build a portfolio because I think some people get limited by their portfolio because they think, oh, it has to be client work or things that I've been paid to do that actually went into the world. Well, it doesn't have to be. You can just create stuff and create a portfolio. So even if today you've never been paid to be a creative or a designer, go make stuff and then you can go and show people, look what I made. I can't tell you the results of it. It didn't go into the world, but you can start to build that up to be able to then go and get that first job, that first opportunity.
That's how I got this job. I was traveling around Europe by myself, but I was also doing my portfolio, but I had never done any paid design work. So I just was kind of picking projects that I thought was interesting and doing them. And one was Nintendo DS. I think it was the DS. Yeah, I think. No, was it the DS? The Switch. The Switch had like an e-store where you would buy the games on, and it was awful. I was chatting to my friend because he had one at the time, and he was just like, this is awful. Because I was asking people, I was like, does anyone have any like bad digital experiences that I can use as a project? And he was like, this store is awful. So I just took the store and I was like, okay, I'll do like a review of it and I'll see what's bad and I'll try and improve it. And then I put that up on my website as one of my projects with a couple more. So when I was like interviewing around for places, like I would send on the website and the portfolio. So it was like, one of the things that got me this job initially was those kind of projects. You don't need paid work to start off. I didn't have any. I was just kind of doing things out of interest and trying to, tell that story and present it really nice on a website. And I think I used Webflow at the time to make the website, but there's so many good no-code website builders as well that have come out now. Like, I've been trying Framer lately, which is really nice as well. I'm switching away from Webflow now.
Oh, interesting.
Because it's really similar to Figma where you can like drag and move things around. Whereas I feel like Webflow is a lot more, it feels like a dev built Webflow. It feels like a designer built Framer. So, but yeah, it's, I think it's just about being curious, doing things and keep doing them.
Well, the thing that stands out to me that you said there with the ones that the projects you were finding were where you thought there was a bad user experience. So it wasn't just, oh, I fancy making this thing, but actually then in your portfolio there was a story to, I thought this wasn't working as well as it could. I've done some research, I've built this new idea, I've created it, I can show you it. And then actually, then from a business perspective, people can go, oh, this is amazing. This is more than a hobby to this guy. This guy actually gets it. And I think, because I have seen portfolios where people have just done fun stuff, which is nice. But I think the more you can give it a bit of a business side, as you said, as you've been developing more of that business side, it's going to be more valuable to businesses. So therefore, they're going to put you over somebody else because they're going to go, I think this person gets the commerciality of what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Wow. That was a good conversation. Thank you so much, Dan.
Yeah, thanks a million. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And thank you so much, Rehan. That was amazing. Yeah. And we look forward to seeing you on a future episode of Behind the Future. That concludes another brilliant episode of Behind the Future. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen back to other episodes on YouTube or your podcast platform of choice.
Make sure you hit the subscribe button, as that will help us to grow this podcast, ensuring we can get the best guests on here for you to learn from. You can also follow us on socials, linked in the show notes for exclusive content. See you on the next episode.